Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published by the Geographic Society in March of 2025. I'm going to open with this article, which is very timely, at least if you're a baseball fan. The title is How the First Pitch Became Baseball's Opening Day Tradition. It's an honor nearly as old as the Major League itself, but in 1910, President William Howard Taft transformed the first pitch into the popular ceremony it is today. By Amy McKeever. On April 14, 1910, President William Howard Taft was among the thousands of baseball fans who had thronged to the ballpark in Washington, D.C., to watch the Washington Nationals play the Philadelphia Athletics in their first game of the season. But Taft wasn't just there to watch the game. He made history that day by becoming the first sitting U.S. president to throw out the ceremonial first pitch on opening day, a tradition that has been carried on by every U.S. president except Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Though the ceremonial first pitch is usually associated with U.S. presidents, there is a long line of politicians, celebrities, and other notable people who have thrown out first pitches at baseball games, almost since it became a professional sport. In fact, one of the earliest recorded instances was in 1892, when William McKinley, then governor of Ohio and a future U.S. president, threw a pitch at a minor league baseball season opener. But credit for transforming the first pitch into a true baseball tradition generally goes to Taft on that sunny spring day in 1910, when he attended the season opener with his wife, Helen, and Vice President James Sherman. Nationals manager Jimmy McLear came up with the idea for Taft to start the game that day, according to a biography of pitcher Walter Johnson. Taft agreed, but threw in a twist of his own. As the bell rang to start the game, the president rose in the grandstand and prepared to throw, Johnson said. Gabby Street was standing at home plate, waiting for the throw, but suddenly the president shifted his position and aimed at me, and his aim was very good. The next day, sports writers described the events of the game breathlessly. There have been many openings of baseball seasons in Washington, but none such as yesterday, when the Nationals scored a 3-0 victory over the Athletics, J. Ed Grillo wrote in the Washington Post. Every available foot of space was crowded with humanity. The stands were filled to suffocation. The Evening Star noted that the president was one of the best fans of them all, for he stayed to the very end of the contest, until the last Philadelphian was out, and the victory was stowed away safely in the McAleer bat bag. Taft returned to the ballpark the following year, making the presidential opening day pitch a tradition that would endure until the modern era, with most presidents doing so at least once in their tenure. But the tradition has changed a bit through the years. Richard Nixon became the first president to throw out the opening day pitch outside of Washington, D.C. in 1973, when the city temporarily lost its baseball team. In 1988, Ronald Reagan became the first president to throw an opening day pitch from the mound rather than the grandstands. Only two sitting presidents have skipped opening day, Carter and Trump. Carter did throw out the first pitch in the last game of the 1979 World Series, though, and has since thrown out an opening day pitch as well. Trump threw out a pitch at a Red Sox game in 2006, but did not do so as a sitting president. And that's the end of the article, How the First Pitch Became Baseball's Opening Day Tradition, by Amy McKeever. This article is for those of you that have a pet, or maybe are thinking about getting one. The title is, Why Raw Pet Food Isn't Worth the Risk. A recent case of bird flu was linked to a cat's raw food diet. Experts stress there are other health risks too, by Olivia Ferrari. Pet owners on TikTok, who feed their cats and dogs raw food regularly, show off their colorful bowls full of uncooked meats, organs, heads, feet, or bones. The $3.1 billion global raw pet food industry has always been controversial, since the food contains animal protein that hasn't been cooked or heated enough to kill germs. But a recent link to bird flu is sounding a new alarm. In December, a pet food company recalled a batch of its raw turkey frozen food after it tested positive for H5N1, the highly deadly bird flu virus. A house cat who had consumed the food died from the virus, and genetic testing matched the cat's virus with the virus in the food. It's not the only recorded case. A house cat in California also tested positive for the H5N1 virus in December after consuming a different brand of raw pet food. And in March, bird flu was detected in two domestic cats in New York, linked to another type of raw pet food. These cats all died. Some commercial raw food is frozen, freeze-fried, or dehydrated, which may give people a false sense of security about its safety. Amy Simpson, the medical director at VCA Cat Hospital of Philadelphia, says it's important to note that these methods are not reliable or effective ways to kill bacteria or viruses like avian influenza. Cats are especially susceptible to H5N1, and the current strain has a high fatality rate in felines, Simpson adds. Dogs can become ill, but it's less likely they'll become seriously ill. Why pet owners choose raw food. The raw pet food scene emerged in the 1990s as a healthier alternative to commercial pet food. Today, some pet owners choose raw diets to feed their cat or dog what their ancestors would have eaten in the wild. They say it improves health, giving cats and dogs shinier coats, cleaner teeth, and better digestion. Raw diets also enable owners to control what goes into their pet's food, avoiding additives and preservatives in many commercial pet foods. Yet, the supposed health benefits of raw pet food diets are not strongly supported by scientific evidence, says Antonio Varcassia, a scientist at the University of Sassari in Italy, who studies how parasites spread in animals. He adds that improperly balanced raw diets can also result in nutritional deficits, like too much protein or too little fiber. There are some surveys of owners who feel that their pet is healthy and doing well, but this is not scientific evidence of benefit, says Jennifer Larson, a veterinary nutritionist at the University of California, Davis. And in light of the growing raw pet food trend, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the World Small Animal Veterinary Association, the FDA, and the Centers for Disease Control have all issued statements advising against raw diets. What's wrong with a raw food diet for your pet? What is very evident are the possible disadvantages and risks for the pet and the owner, Varkasia says. Pets that eat a raw food diet can be exposed to parasitic infections like Toxoplasma gondii, the leading cause of death from foodborne illness in the U.S., and Echinococcus granulosus, a tapeworm that can cause gastrointestinal issues and may be fatal if spread to humans, which can happen through direct contact with food or via contaminated surfaces. Bacterial contamination can occur too, since Salmonella, E. coli, and Listeria are commonly found in raw meat and can cause severe GI illness in animals and humans. A 2023 Salmonella outbreak in humans was linked to handling raw dog food, and a 2017 E. coli outbreak in humans was tied to dogs that were fed a raw diet. Now, bird flu joins the list of possible germs that can get into raw pet food, likely due to infected chickens being used as an ingredient. On farms, bird flu killed over 20 million chickens in 2024. Cats and dogs can be infected if they eat sick or dead infected wild birds, drink unpasteurized milk or cream from infected cows, or eat undercooked or raw meat from infected ducks and chickens, says Iowa State University veterinary pathologist Sylvia Carnesini. How to protect your pets and yourself. The AVMA has issued recommendations for cat owners, which include keeping cats indoors to prevent exposure to wild birds, thoroughly cooking meat before feeding, and avoiding raw meat-based treats or foods. They also recommend feeding cats dairy products only if they have been pasteurized or thoroughly cooked, and immediately contacting your veterinarian if you notice signs of bird flu in your cat. Symptoms include fever, tremors, heavy nasal discharge, and rapid or difficult breathing. Symptoms would also be similar in dogs, but are likely to be less severe, although no cases have been confirmed in dogs in the U.S. during this most recent outbreak. Unfortunately, no approved vaccines or treatments are available yet to protect pets against H5N1, which is why these precautions are so important, writes Carnesini. The risk of a human contacting the H5N1 virus from an infected pet is low, according to the CDC, and it hasn't happened yet with H5N1, says National Institutes of Health virologist Martha Nelson. It can go in that direction, of pet-to-human transmission, but it's extremely rare, Nelson says. For many pathogens, including influenza, there appears to be a strong biological barrier for transmission from pet dogs and cats to people. To keep pets safe, Nelson recommends keeping your cat indoors so it doesn't scavenge dead infected birds, and not feeding pets raw pet food that could potentially be contaminated. Varkasia says that if pet owners insist on feeding their pets a raw diet, they should consult a veterinarian, ensure the chosen brand adheres to strict safety regulations, and consider the origins of the ingredients. But the safest choice is to avoid raw food altogether, Nelson says. Not feeding your cat raw pet food is a pretty easy, implementable guideline. That completes the article, Why Raw Pet Food Isn't Worth the Risk, by Olivia Ferrari. Our next article is titled Unraveling the Mysteries of the World's Most Critical Rainforest. For decades, the Congo Basin was largely invisible to climate science. Now, a new generation of Central African researchers is revealing unexpected ways to protect the planet. By Melanie Gaubi. Within the dense canopy of the Congo Basin rainforest, the afternoon light began to fade, glinting off a soaring metal tower that rose steeply out of the jungle. Measuring 180 feet tall, the narrow steel structure resembled a massive cellular network antenna, although it was outfitted with a collection of far more critical scientific sensors. The wind had picked up, causing the spire to sway and whine with every strong gust. But a biologist named Fabrice Kimbessa appeared undaunted. After strapping into a safety harness, he grabbed hold of a thin metal ladder and clambered up briskly, leaving me to catch up as he raced toward a small platform at the very top. This particular structure is what's known as an eddy covariance flux tower. When it came online in October 2020, it became the first ever to be located in the Congo Basin. For climate researchers who track greenhouse gas exchanges between the forest and the atmosphere, such spires essentially act like enormous stethoscopes. They're capable of tracking how much carbon dioxide is released and taken up by the forest to help calculate the world's emissions being sequestered back into the earth, among many other factors. And so every day, Kimbessa makes the nerve-wracking climb to check the equipment's readings, monitoring with precision how the forest breathes around him. When you look at the data, you get the sense that you now have a special connection with the forest, he says. You can see things others don't. Today, after hours of baking beneath the hot equatorial sun, the rainforest seems to be exhaling, its canopy engulfed in clouds of mist. The recorded data shows a more specific trend. Over the past 24 hours, carbon dioxide levels in the area dropped substantially during the day, as trees and other plants converted the greenhouse gas to oxygen during photosynthesis, only to creep back up after sunset. This kind of work has never been more vital. Tropical forests were once responsible for sequestering roughly half of Earth's carbon stored on land, but their overall efficiency is declining since a peak in the 1990s. The Congo Basin encompasses the world's second largest rainforest behind the Amazon, spanning about 5 million acres across Central Africa. Yet while more than 1,000 flux towers have been collecting data about gas exchange rates around the globe for decades, this region has been a blank spot until 2020. Several years ago, an international consortium of researchers revealed that based on a sample of tropical old-growth forest plots across the Congo Basin, the rainforest appears to be storing carbon at a steadier rate than the Amazon, where the absorption rate has rapidly diminished. But the researchers also noted that since 2010, the African rainforest has seemed to be following a downward path similar to its South American counterparts. To figure out what was really happening, and perhaps offer some solutions, Kimbessa and a cohort of newly trained Congolese scientists now operate out of a revitalized research station within the Yangambi Biosphere Reserve, a 900-square-mile protected area in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The idea that Kimbessa, who recently graduated from the nearby University of Sinkangani, might be an important contributor to this research once seemed inconceivable. The DRC, where more than half of the Congo Basin rainforest lies, still suffers from deep poverty and a history of colonial exploitation, dictatorship, and conflicts that have both held back the development of a solid university system and restricted employment and resources for local scientists. But as the ecological significance of the region has become more apparent, it has drawn increased attention from global conservation groups such as the Center for International Forestry Research, which has teamed with governments and universities to invest millions in infrastructure, technology, and training of researchers. Since 2005, the number of postgraduates in forestry has grown from just 6 to more than 300. Today, this new vanguard of Congolese scientists is striving to understand one of the most massive and understudied ecosystems on our planet, at a time when it's needed most. Scattered across some 60,000 acres, Yangambi's dilapidated colonial facilities remain a testament to the research station's tainted origins. The nearest major city is Kisangani, about 70 miles away, which is where Belgium's King Leopold II in 1885 founded one of the first settlements of what would become his own private colony, the Congo Free State, after his government refused to sanction a state-backed expansion into the territory. The king's emissaries arrived to discover the rainforest's vast troves of rubber vines, which could be tapped for latex to fuel the global rubber boom. To harvest ever more latex, however, the nascent colony required a workforce, and Leopold's officials contracted with private companies that enslaved indigenous people in vast numbers. An estimated 10 million people were killed as a result of famine, disease, and the colonizers' brutality. The government of Belgium had wrested control away from Leopold by 1908 and established the Belgian Congo. During its rule, the new government created the National Institute for Agronomic Study of the Belgian Congo at Yangambi to explore the rainforest and figure out what other crops could be successfully cultivated there. Colonial Belgian researchers collected and analyzed tens of thousands of plant specimens and stored them at Yangambi, where they are still housed today. In the Yangambi station's archives, head librarian Christian Bisambi Afanta leads me to a corner behind rows of wooden bookcases filled with decades of scientific journals. The collection includes black and white photographs, several of which he spreads out across a large mid-century desk, pointing to images of beans and seeds at various stages of sprouting, along with close-ups of the different roots and leaves of many plants. Belgians wanted to understand the structure of each existing species and determine its economic value, he explains. This led to the rise of palm tree, rice, and coffee plantations, including the introduction of a still popular variety of Robusta coffee bean. By 1960, Congolese pro-independence leaders had rallied enough support to force Belgian authorities to grant the country independence and organize general elections. Belgian researchers left without having trained a single Congolese scientist to replace them. The Belgians did not want to train anyone to be their equal. The goal was to subjugate, Afanta says. And so, after their departure, everything remained in a state of lethargy. But not everyone abandoned Yangambi. At independence, the workers from surrounding villages recruited by Belgian scientists to perform small technical tasks, kept quietly going about those tasks, even without the guarantee of payment from the newly formed Congolese state. And when they became too old to carry on, their sons took over, continuing the important duty of chronicling changes throughout the region. 5 times a day, observers like Henry Algoui Angwali still do the work that has gone on for generations at the research station. One morning I join him as he heads out to a grassy field a few miles away to meticulously record the meteorological data available from an assortment of rudimentary instruments that are arranged at intervals like a contemporary art installation. Using a pen and paper, he checks the readings on a pair of rain gauges, the same ones that were installed in 1928, and a totalizing anemometer, which measures the speed and direction of the wind over time. My father began working here decades ago. It was his life, Angwali says, but he was too tired, so Angwali took over the job from his father, who passed away just 6 months after retiring. And with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time today. The name of this article was Unraveling the Mysteries of the World's Most Critical Rainforest by Melanie Gauby. This has been the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles were all published by the Geographic Society in March of 2025. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed an article you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then on the next page, click on Demand Podcasts. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.